Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Today, the latest on the tragic events unfolding in Newtown, Connecticut, and a special guest talking fiscal cliff issues. Join us as Club for Growth joins Backroom Politics to talk about the future of fiscal issues in the United States. This is a special edition of Backroom Politics. Joining us in a mad rush, he is, as he is every Tuesday at my 11 o'clock, is the former Undersecretary of Commerce, longtime Senate staffer, longtime Washington Insider, and a very distinguished fellow at the Simpson Center. He is Alan Moore. Hello, Alan.
Hello, gentlemen.
And to my 12 o'clock, as he is every Tuesday, he is the former floor director for Congressman Gerald Ford. He is the former Vice President of Government Affairs for the National Broadcasting Corporation. He is the Honorable Bob Hines. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Justin. Glad to be here on this chilly but not bad day at all
not
in Washington.
Not bad day at all in Washington. The week started off a little gloomy, but rightfully so. We have got so much to talk about. We've got special guests joining us at the 4:30 hour. He is the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Club for Growth. He is Andy Roth. Andrew Roth will be joining us in the 4:30 hour to talk about fiscal cliff issues and the future of the budget in America. But we're going to start off on what can only be said is a senseless, violent tragedy over the weekend that happened in Newtown, Connecticut, in northern Fairfield County. It is, for lack of a better term, a senseless act of violence. It is a tragedy on a scale that, in my 41 years on this planet, I've never seen before. For those of you who may or may not know, last Friday, a gunman, a gentleman by the name of Andrew Lanza, walked into the Sandy Hook Elementary School in Newtown, Connecticut, armed to the hilt, and proceeded to murder, for lack of a better term, 20 children, 6 adults, all in the school. Of the adults killed, it includes his own mother, who was found dead at their residence outside of Newtown. The state of Connecticut, the entire country for that matter, is still stunned over these tragic events. There is still an investigation ongoing. The elementary school itself is still a crime scene, and more facts are going to be coming out about this this tragedy, for lack of a better term. I can tell you right now that it is something that nobody can describe. You feel for the loss of children. You feel for the parents of those children. You feel for the first responders that had to walk into that building to see that kind of senseless carnage. It is mind-boggling. But it is the big discussion going on here in Washington and nationwide. So it is going to be something that we're going to be talking about here in the opening scenes. I got to go, Alan Moore, I'll start with you. Alan, when you saw the first reports coming into this. You know, what's going through your mind as all this is happening?
Well, I think the thing that tends to grab any of us is projecting horror onto our own personal lives. And whether it's children or grandchildren or nieces and nephews or friends of neighbors, especially when it's such small children. We've seen tragedies in high schools. We've seen tragedies at colleges. In this particular case, it's 6 and 7-year-olds who are the victims of the slaughter. And then you shake your head and think, what is happening that these things can occur with what seems like increasing regularity? And people use the phrase, our hearts break. Our hearts hurt. We suffer pain for those who had the loss, but we also project those losses onto ourselves and embrace our children and our loved ones a little bit more. And then after a little bit of reflection, we start wondering, okay, what do we do? We have to do something. We can't do nothing. Figuring that out is something I'm sure we'll talk about. There's nothing easy, but
I mean, obviously, Congressman Al, this brings up so many discussions, whether it's gun control, whether it's something like how we deal with mental health in this nation, the safety of children in schools. Is now the time? Is this the type of event that should reinvigorate?
Absolutely. And we need to do all of the above. But the one that's going to draw the most attention is, of course, some form of gun control. And I must admit that I have thought about gun control seriously very little in the last 20, 30 years. It wasn't going to happen. There wasn't any point. I staked that position on it, but no thought. Now you need to think about it seriously. And here are a couple of things that come to mind. The anti-gun people have allowed the NRA primarily and other gun supporters to basically outline the argument. And the argument they've outlined is, we're against gun confiscation. Now, I don't know of anybody who is for gun confiscation, but if you tell the average American that you're going to come in and take away everybody's gun, they're going to be opposed to it. So the first thing I think the gun control people need to do is to make clear that we are not trying to take away everybody's gun, that we're talking about licensing, that we're talking about maybe some controls on weapons of war that have somehow crept into domestic arsenals, and begin to build a case that the middle people in this country can understand and buy into.
Bob Hines, we've heard a lot about gun control issues. I mean, this has been a huge issue following what happened out in Oregon in the mall shooting, what happened out in Aurora, Colorado, in the theater mass shootings. I mean, buried in the tragedy in Connecticut, word got out that 2 police officers in Kansas City were gunned down violently. There was a shooting at a hospital in the Midwest. At what point does America sit down and say, look, this takes into consideration so many things, we've got to find a starting point?
Well, we obviously have got to take another look at our gun laws. And, you know, I'm always struck by the fact that that somehow this conversation, you know, we start off with gun control, which is a dangerous word. You know, you think about, you know, what does all that mean, control? Well, mostly when we talk about, you know, issues that have to be dealt with, they are regulatory issues. And that's what we're talking here, legislative regulation about weapons. Now, I don't know of any rational person who thinks that it's wrong for hunters to be able to have hunting rifles or shotguns if they shoot birds or whatever. I don't think that's. I think, you know, if you're regulated and you've got a license both to hunt and to have weapons, I see no problem with that. But we're not talking to that. You know, these events that have happened in recent months tend not to be the kinds of weapons that a hunter uses. There are these automatic weapons, and there are these a magazine of 6 shots or 8 shots. They're 30 shots. I mean, the only thing you do with weapons like that is you kill a lot of whatever you're shooting at. I mean, nobody, no hunter in his right mind is going to take a bushwhacker gun out and shoot 30 shells into a deer. I mean, come on. That's not the way the hunters do things.
Well, I want to hold that thought. We're going to take a quick break here. When we come back, we're going to continue the discussion on the tragic events in Newtown. And I want to bring up, you know, the first line that comes up is the issue about gun control. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll continue this discussion. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 S Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 2 minutes. Stay with us.
You know, you hear us talk about Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. It's being the place to be. America's premier cigar tavern, place to make new friends or visit old friends, or even have a lively political discussion like we do here on Backroom Politics. But what you may not know, Shelley's is the place for private parties. Shelley's Backroom is available to host events for groups of 10 to 250. From cocktail receptions to sit-down dinners, Shelley's can provide custom menu options to suit your needs and budget. Although Shelley's is a smoke-friendly environment, Shelley's can make accommodations for non-smokers based on the size of your party, but heck, why would you want to? With a cigar menu like they have here, why would you even consider going smoke-free? Event pricing varies based on the time of the day of the week chosen for your event. For more information on private parties at Shelley's Backroom, go to www.shelleysbackroom.com/private-party. Shelley's Backroom, the place to be, as Bob likes to say it. It's also the place for private parties.
Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, in Washington, D.C. We're going to be talking about the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut, which has just captivated the mind of everybody in our nation. I want to go back to Carl Tuven. Carl, you know, when you look at the discussion of gun control, when you look at the issue of, you know, having an event like this spark the nation having to go back to the table and look at how we deal with guns, why does it have to take something like Newtown to spark this off?
Well, I think the important thing about Newtown is the age of the children and the number of children that were killed and just shot. I mean, one child had 11 bullets in him, who was buried yesterday. I think this is really why this is back on the table. This is a horrific situation.
Congressman Al, are we politicizing this event? I mean, are we politicizing the tragic events in Newtown by even having this discussion right now? Or is this the time to have it?
It is a political situation. I mean, the NRA has been politically active for years.
Now, oddly enough, the NRA has been just extremely, unusually quiet throughout this whole ordeal.
Which is very smart of them. But they have been the primary politicizer of the issue over time. People don't kill guns.
Guns don't kill people. People kill people.
And all of that bumper sticker logic that they use. So no, we are not politicizing it. What I am suggesting is we need to start thinking about seriously taking political action, and that means that we don't go off half-cocked and promise that there will never be another incident like this. Clearly, you can't put an end to crazy people who want to do crazy things. But you can certainly reduce the number of people killed by those people if you can reduce the number of firearms that are lying around.
Alan Moore, the NRA has been quiet. The Republicans, the pro-gun Republicans, those who have an A rating with the NRA, have also been unusually quiet about this. Is it a matter of now's the time that everybody has to relook at their position on this, or is it just a matter of waiting and getting the right position ready to go?
Both. Yes, everybody has to reweigh their position. A few people who have had long histories of support of pretty much unregulated gun rights, a few of them said, we have to take another look. They also want to see how this sorts out over the next days and weeks. Nobody's going to make any policy in the next 48, 72 hours. We're not going to pass laws relating to this. But this is the kind of call that really hits everybody. And there's a serious, you know, question of what do we do? There's a need to do something. There's also a need to acknowledge that we can't pass a law that's going to prevent these kinds of things from happening. But as Al said, we have to take a stab at a start. And there are some elements that we may get into that one can look at that are likely going to be the framework of some new law going forward. But in a country with 200 million guns, we're not going to outlaw gun ownership. And any law we pass, because of everything that's out there, is going to have limited impact in the short run. But that's not an excuse for doing nothing.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about the issues that surround this. But I also want to go to number one, the president's response to this. President Obama immediately, in an emotional statement later that afternoon on Friday, address the nation regarding this tragedy. Let's start with you, Bob Hines. Probably one of the most presidential moments we've seen out of this president. Would you agree?
Yes, I would. And I thought one of the finest things I saw, Don, was that those remarks that he made, and as he called out the names of all those children, just their first names, and I thought it was so moving. And I thought to myself, This is a president dealing with a major catastrophe for America, in the sense that these 20 young kids killed, 26 and 7-year-old kids. He did a marvelous job of standing in for the United States citizens as a whole and saying, this is a terrible thing, and really, really, it's a terrible thing to have happened, and we've got to find a way.
Congressman Al.
And he didn't use it as an opportunity to politicize it. That will come later.
I mean, he truly was a consoler in chief on Friday,
yes.
And then the following subsequent visit to Connecticut, he really did a good job at that.
Yes.
Alan Moore, looking at the response, which has to be a hard response of Governor Malloy, Democratic governor of Connecticut, did he do a good job in truly not only conveying the sorrow of the people of Connecticut, but also addressing the nation as the chief executive of the state, which endured this tragedy?
You know, this would not. I watched him. I thought he was perfectly appropriate. If I thought he was not perfectly appropriate, I don't know that I would say so. I mean, this is a sensitive, delicate time. Nobody has experience in dealing with this. Not the governor, not the local alderman, the mayor, not the president. The president's got some practice in coming in after disasters. When you're dealing with six-year-olds and seven-year-olds and the teacher's trying to protect them, nothing prepares you for that. I think everybody has done a remarkably good job. And as I say, if I thought they hadn't, they would have to be really, really bad for me to say anything about it. And I don't feel that way. I'm just saying, it's tough, tough stuff.
Carl, I want to go to you. You know, when you look at the community coming together, what struck you about how that whole community in Newtown, Connecticut, and the entire state came together?
Well, you know, I went to school in Vermont, and in small, and had a lot of interaction with small towns. And everyone knows one another, and everyone knows everybody else's business, and they trade with one another. And I think this is what it was. Is this happened, and everyone empathized, sympathized with everybody, and that's how it came together so nicely and so quickly. One thing about the governor, the senator-elect, Lieberman, Blumenthal, evidently they were, I know the governor left the mansion, got in his car, and went right down to Newtown. And the senators and others were not far behind, just to be there to see what they could do to help, which I think was very, very important that you had the elected officials, statewide elected officials there.
Now, in all during this time, it has not been political. It will get political. Senator Feinstein has indicated that she will introduce legislation. Others will introduce legislation. And then the debate will begin. And how the debate is carried out is going to be very interesting. If this is the usual gun debate where everybody is screaming at each other, it will be a tragedy for those children. But if everybody can sit down and come up with something reasonable, starting with the fact you're not going to confiscate all the guns, you're going to just take a look at what are appropriate uses for guns and whether they can be appropriately licensed so that when guns are used in crimes, they can be followed up and so forth.
Bob Hines first and Alan Moore.
You know, I think that this particular event is more, as horrible as the events have been at other schools and universities or malls or anything else, the idea that the most great majority of the victims were 6 and 7 year old children, boys and girls in their supposedly safe classrooms with their teachers. And the reality is, I think it hits more people in a harder way than it might hit another kind of event of similar evil. Might also be bad, but it's not quite as bad as young children being killed. And that may help the discussion on this issue to progress along lines that are a little less, you know, predetermined. And, NRA making, you know, saying guns don't kill people, people don't kill people, guns do. The liberals saying we've got to regulate them out of business. I think we might very well find that the debate is more substantive, more rational, and being handled in a way that tries to solve the problem in a way that is rational, rather than have a situation where each side of a political discussion, like gun control is, each part of it, people are going to be more rational about it, and they're going to try to find a solution to it because it was so hard.
You know, it's funny because you see what came out of. I mean, the stories coming out of the school itself, where you heard the acts of courage of the teachers who were trying to keep, you know, 6-year-olds, 10-year-olds, you know, keep them collected and keep them safe, you know, hiding in closets while this madman is running around. Truly remarkable, to a point where, you know, my sister-in-law is a public school teacher in New York City. You know, we hear about the first responders. You know, we put a lot of emphasis on the police and the fire responders and the emergency management people. You know, when it comes to public service, I called up my sister after hearing those stories, called up my sister-in-law and actually thanked her for being a true member of public service. That's a tough job, Alan Moore. Is you know, we don't pay enough attention to the sacrifices that teachers make, and then you hear those stories and it makes you relook at it, Alan.
Well, I think it's fair to say that we often undervalue teachers. We also know of situations where teachers and teachers' unions have exerted considerable power, and there are fights going on around the country. Being a physical protector of students against assault weapons is not part of that job. What you do see in this case is teachers acting as surrogate parents. They have attachments to these little kids, and they leap forward to protect. Lots of teachers around the country would have done that. Lots of adults do that sometimes for strangers, particularly for children. And so I give them full credit. I'm not surprised. You asked before about the community of Newtown and what struck me about that. And what struck me was that community rallied around those families, the families who suffered the most horrible of losses, the way most communities in this country and many other countries would have done. They were fabulous, and I think had it been in another place, we would be saying the same thing. What a fabulous embrace of that community! But it doesn't take away the horror, I think again we all personalize this one in big ways, and we'd like to think there would be a way to reduce the risk, prevent in the future, and a lot of soul searching is going to go along, gone, a lot of reflection. There's a reference to Dianne Feinstein, who was very involved in the assault weapons ban of 1994 that expired in 2004. She will almost certainly become the new chairman of the Judiciary Committee, I'm sure we'll talk about Senator Dan Inouye's passing.
Yeah.
But part of the sequence of events is that she will presumably take over the chairmanship of the Judiciary Committee, so she will have even more power to pursue this, which isn't to say that she's going to get the kind of resistance that she would have gotten even a week ago.
Well, we're going to talk about the politics and the issues that the situation in Newtown brought up here later in the show. But we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to have Andrew Roth, who's the Vice President of Government Affairs for Club for Growth here in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk to him about the fiscal cliff. There's breaking news coming out of Washington. Apparently, a counteroffer has gone back and forth between the president and Speaker Boehner. Speaker Boehner has come out and said that they are looking at Plan B, whatever that is. We'll talk about that when we get back. This is Backroom Politics live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 877-662-3713, toll free. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, we usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands, and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelly's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lula's back in town. Yeah.
Shelly's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics on Blog Talk Radio. We're live today with a special guest. He's the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Club for Growth here in Washington, D.C. You've seen him on MSNBC, Fox News, C-SPAN, all over the place talking about budgetary and fiscal issues. He is Andy Roth. Andy, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it. First of all, for those who are not familiar, talk a little bit, what is the Club for Growth? And talk about its background.
Sure. The Club for Growth is a membership organization out of Washington, D.C., but we've got 100,000 members all across the country from all walks of life, from all 50 states, and we're united because we believe in one thing, and that's economic liberty, lower taxes, limited government.
How long has the Club for Growth been around?
Well, you can talk to different people, and you get different answers, but it's been around since about 1999. I've been there since 2003, and it's been a great time ever since.
Now, obviously, with fiscal cliff, with debt ceiling, with taxation issues coming up on board, you guys, I'm sure, have been very vocal and very busy over the past few weeks.
We have, and it's going in a direction that we don't like, and it's unfortunate that there doesn't appear to be any voices that's putting it in the right direction.
Let's get down to the heart of this. The fiscal cliff that we're looking at, there's been back and forth, offers, counter offers. Do any of the offers for Club for Growth spark any sort of, ooh, we can live with that, or absolutely not?
Well, let me back up just a little bit. During the super committee, as you guys may recall from the last debt deal, Senator Pat Toomey offered a proposal that put revenue on the table for the first time. This, for a lot of people, was considered a tax increase. And Pat Toomey, full disclosure, used to be the president of the Club for Growth. We were supportive of that idea, which was a broad-based tax reform that wasn't revenue neutral. It actually brought in some tax revenue. Some would have thought that may have violated the tax pledge. We were okay with that. So when Boehner started talking about putting revenue on the table, we were cautiously optimistic that may be okay. But then it just starts spiraling out of control, and we're at that point now where it doesn't look like anything.
Where was Club for Growth on Simpson Bolts? Supportive?
Well, as a whole, if we were to take it whole hog, we weren't supportive. We never.
Why not?
Well, there was too many things in there that we disagreed. capital gains tax as high as they wanted to. And now, obviously, that was part of broad tax reform. But the capital gains tax is a very interesting beast in that when you mess with that, you're really messing with the growth of the economy when you raise that substantially like they want.
But, I mean...
That wasn't our only thing.
That was the big part of it. Right. But when we look at Simpson-Bowles, I mean, you're talking about two, you know, a staunch Democrat, staunch Republican, putting together what some viewed as a true bipartisan,
yeah,
it's going to hurt everybody's solution. Is that solution viable? I mean, can Club for Growth literally say, we don't like it, but it's something that we have to say it might work?
Well, let me put it in the words of Alice Rivlin, who was part of that.
Right.
She was like, I have problems with Simpson-Bowles too, she said, but she voted for it just to move it along. We would have been happy, you know, supporting the idea of the general idea of Simpson-Bowles was tax reform, entitlement reform, and there are certain mechanisms to do that. We can bicker about the details, but at least going in that direction and talking about those things, fantastic. We're on.
But we have a situation right now where literally the growth of government, anywhere from 8 to 10% annually, is just out of control, and we're spending more than we're taking in.
Right.
It's not just as simple as going to a clean slate and reforming and rewriting the tax code altogether. There's other things that have got to be put in place. Would you agree?
Well, certainly on the spending side, yeah. Well, I mean, the spending is the driver of the debt, we believe. So yes, there needs to be entitlement. But there is broad bipartisan support right now for comprehensive tax reform, both on the corporate side and the individual side. And I can't wait for that to happen. And I think it will happen this summer.
But you guys do support putting revenue on the table, maybe a point extra for everybody on the table?
You're talking tax rate.
Tax rate.
No, we're not supportive of tax rate increases. Like I said, we were supportive of the idea of putting revenue on the table when it came to, like, broadening the base. And getting rid of a lot of special interest loopholes.
Okay.
But raising rates is, one, typically anti-growth, and two, I don't even think that it's what Democrats support, believe it or not. I know that may sound really far out, but hear me out on this. Democrats, including President Obama, want corporate tax rates. They admit that we are at a competitive disadvantage globally.
Right.
And the way to do that is to lower rates and broaden the base on corporations. Now, you cannot simultaneously do that while raising rates for the wealthy in the individual taxpayer. You could do that, but wealthy individuals will game the system and incorporate in order to get the lower rate. So, hold on. And then Democrats are now in the position of defending multinational corporations while Republicans are citing small businesses. People that file through the individual tax code. So my overall point is that there's broad bipartisan support for tax reform, and you can't do that while simultaneously raising rates.
But when you talk about putting revenue on the table, it's a matter of generating revenue to put into the coffers of the Treasury.
Right.
Does that include more strict enforcement of the tax rule, as far as getting people who owe taxes to pay up?
Right. I mean, there are a lot of different ways to do it. You can raise rates and bring in more that way, although that's a force that is delicate because you may hinder growth, which will lower tax collection. You can also strengthen tax collection through enforcement mechanisms. Or, and here's my favorite, is let's grow the coffers of the Treasury through economic growth. And that's the way that there is bipartisan support. There's a lot of partisan bickering right now. You can overcome that. And I think that that is the path forward.
But Bob Hines, go ahead.
When we talk about raising revenues, I think you're talking about cleaning up the tax code, not changing any rates.
Well, we can talk about a lot of things, but I think the best path forward is to broaden the base by cleaning up the tax code and lowering rates.
There's no doubt we have to clean up the tax code.
Right.
But if we I've seen numbers, and I don't, you know, there's a thousand numbers going around these days, but I saw a major piece in the, I think it was in the Post about a week ago, they had a whole list of all these deductions that are in the code, and it would raise approximately, if you took everything, it would raise about $800 billion. Is that right?
Well, I don't know exactly what you're talking about, but
you probably saw the report.
Well, I do know that a lot of the reports that are generated in this town are generated using static models, which is you raise rates by X amount, you gain revenue by that amount. We believe that there is an economic component to that, where if you raise rates, some people might stop and divert income to avoid those higher rates. You're seeing it happen now. You've seen all the companies right now that are announcing special dividends so that they can avoid the higher rates. The models that you speak of don't factor that sort of economic behavior.
Are they trying to avoid taxes, or are they trying to use some of the money in their pocket to make their shareholders happy and put some money in the economy?
But,
I mean, I don't know enough about this.
And it's creating perverse effects. Look at all of the companies right now that are buying back their stock rather than building.
Berkshire Hathaway just announced a big stock buyback.
Right. I mean, rather than put that money to work in the economy, they're buying back their stock because the economy is in such doldrums. You've got companies like Costco who are borrowing money at the low, low rates that we currently have, which is wrong, and using it to pay dividends. I mean, that's really perverse behavior that's going on right now, and that's because we've got all this.
Does that create its own fiscal bubble into itself?
Yeah, I agree. But I agree that the best way forward, even if we come up with a plan that may be ambiguously pro-growth, the certainty that it would provide the economy is enormous.
But, you know, it seems to me that what we lack here in D.C., and we've said this many times on the show before, is there's no, when it comes to the fiscal cliff and when it comes to the size of government, when it comes to generating revenue, there's no true political leadership. Like what we saw with George Bush 41, where he ran on no new taxes. His economic team came to him and said, boss, we can't sustain this. We had to raise taxes. Cost him the White House, cost him his political future. Do we need to see that type of political leadership now to maybe bring us into the next level of fiscal growth in our country?
Well, maybe. We kind of joke internally at the Club for Growth about our perverse affection for Nancy Pelosi. She has principle, and she took Obamacare against all odds and put it into law, even though she knew that it was politically destructive for her. And they did it. And you're not seeing that on the Republicans. And I wish that there was somebody out there that would promote the ideas that would get this through Congress. Right now you've got Republicans capitulating themselves as best they can to see who can raise taxes. And I think that's a mistake.
Alan Moore.
I'm intrigued with the notion that what Republicans need is their own very own Nancy Pelosi. It seems to me that Republicans have had a number of folks who have pushed hard, not with great impact or effect, to make the argument for holding firm on taxes, because higher tax rates would be anti-growth. But one can argue whether point was made very well in the course of the campaign. It's a hard one to make. It's sort of counterintuitive, especially given the inequalities in this country in both income and wealth. But fact of the matter is, they did a credible job, I think. They lost. They lost by 3%, but in terms of the national popular vote, but they really lost bigger than that. And so now the question for Mr. Boehner is, so what do we do? And I think that what he's trying to do now, from an economic standpoint, is damage control. we're not going to capitulate to some of the really excessive stuff that the White House asked for, particularly in its opening gambit, which was a bit of a laugher because some of it was so ridiculous. But it was a bargaining position, and they're moving back from that, and the Speaker had to decide, are we just going to say, let's go over the cliff? Because all the polls indicate that would hurt the Republicans more than it would hurt the Democrats, and that it would do significant damage.
Did you just say the laughter was ridiculous?
But I mean, go ahead, Alan Moore.
No, so I think the Republicans are in a position where they have to deal. Well, they can either say, we're not going to deal, go over the cliff, take the blame, and watch a lot of damage to the economy, or try to work with the president, try to get the best deal you possibly can, and move on to fight another day. And I'm guessing that one of the things that's happened here behind the scenes is that the Republicans have talked to a lot of economists and a lot of business leaders and said, help us here. What is worse for the country? Going over the cliff or cutting a bad deal? And I'm guessing that the answer is almost universally, take the bad deal, try to make it the least bad, and we'll go fight another day once we get past this cliff period. Because all we're talking about for the cliff is 10-year trillion revenue, trillion spending. We could argue the details. And then tax reform over the course of this year. Now, wealthy people need to recognize they're going to get hit twice. They're going to get hit on some rate increases. I don't think we'll go to 39.6. Maybe we'll have two new rates. But for the upper end, you're going to get hit by the rates now and by tax reform later. Because let's face it, when we're talking tax reform, we're talking about the charitable deduction, the mortgage deduction, the tax-free treatment of health benefits, and tax-free treatment of retirement benefits. Those are the biggies where the big dough is that we're going to address in tax reform.
Andy?
Well, first of all, I think that a less bad deal is detrimental long-term. Everybody's talking about the fiscal cliff and the impact it will have on the economy. Everybody's talking about the blame that Republicans will reap if they take a bad deal. This is short-term thinking. The only thing anybody should be thinking about is the long-term health of our economy and our country. And so Republicans should not be worried about who gets blamed for what. They should not be worried about what the fiscal cliff will do to the economy in the short term. They need to demand long-term structural reforms and make sure that happens. And if it doesn't, then they're kicking the can down the road, and they're actually exacerbating this. Look, we are at 70%, going on to 80% debt to GDP. We can't just keep punting this down the road and hope the tax reform will occur or entitlement reform will happen at some point.
Alan Moore, you want to respond to that?
Yeah, he makes a very good point, but that's a point of great contention. If we go over the cliff and we suffer damage, will that be short-term or long-term damage? And what a lot of the economists think is, if you go over the cliff and trigger a recession, that's not short-term. That will have a much longer life. If it was going to be 6 months, a year, then I think you'd have a lot more Republicans say, go over the damn cliff. We'll take the short-term hit because we think in the long-term it will turn around. I think that many people think that short term would be so severe and so problematic to dig out of that it would have a much longer impact. Just as in 2007, when we fell into the hole, we're still suffering from it.
Right, Bob Hines.
I sit here and I listen to this, and I understand exactly what Andy is saying, and I agree with him. Long term is our real problem. But, let's put it this way. We have such a big debt, $16 trillion right now. Even if we move quickly, where are we going to get the revenues to get rid of that deficit, which we have to do?
Now, if we're not going to change any of the programs, and we're not going to raise any revenues except trying to play around with, you know, deductions, which we're not going to get rid of, we're going to keep getting worse and worse in the hole. And I don't, you know, and the reality is, seems to me that it's more important that we solve this problem, whether it means both sides have to compromise or not. The fact of the matter is, if we do not do that, and in a relatively short time, we are going to end up just with such a huge deficit, we cannot get out of the way. It's too big, and I don't know where we're going to get the money to do it. It's right now. We put more money in the hole. We've gone more money in the hole in the last 4 years than we have in the previous 40 years. It's only getting worse. We have got to find a solution, and that's going to mean we have to give on both sides. And that's what negotiations are all about.
Andy Ron.
To be clear, we've been talking about, the credit agencies, the ones that are in charge of maintaining the U.S. rating on our securities, they say they need a $4 trillion deal just to stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio. If you listen to Boehner and President Obama right now, they're not coming anywhere near that. They're talking about $1 trillion in revenue and $1 trillion worth of spending. That's exactly what happened to the debt deal in 2011. They passed a bad deal and the market tanked. Now we've got a workforce economy that just plowed through that anyway. But it's not enough. You have to structure a deal that's pro-growth and attacks the drivers of our debt, which is entitlements. So when we talk about let's raise some revenue and let's cut some spending, that's just not enough. A bad deal or a less bad deal or the best deal is not enough. It's not enough. They will downgrade. In fact, S&P just came out today and said we're probably going to downgrade no matter what.
Well, I mean, does Clifford Grother, do you see any overlapping similarity to where we were in the mid-90s when, at that time, Speaker Newt Gingrich came out and basically forced the shutdown of government? Are we in the same boat here?
No, and I wish we were, though. The Clinton only started negotiating with Newt when they played hardball and they shut down the government. There's no talk on the Republican side about shutting down government, going over the cliff, or letting the debt ceiling expire. There's no talk of that. So Obama.
But aren't we in a different economy, a different economic situation than we were back then?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the debt to GDP ratio was below 50. We were living hot, and now it's much, much worse. Which means we need to come to an answer quicker, a long term answer quicker. So when we talk about passing the best deal that we can, we don't have the luxury of doing it.
Has Club for Growth put forward any options or any possible solutions that might get bipartisan support on either side, House or Senate?
Well, you mentioned Simpson Bowles before, and there is bipartisan support for tax reform, which means lower rates, broadening the base. We like that. There is, and I say this cautiously because there's not as much bipartisan support on this, but there, you know, Alice Rivlin and a lot of other prominent Democrats have talked about entitlement reform, whether it's block granting Medicaid. There's been the Rivlin-Ryan plan or the Ryan-Wyden plan, which is vouchers for Medicare with a Medicare public option. We don't like that, but we like the idea of moving towards premium assistance. And then, of course, we like the old discarded idea of personal accounts for Social Security.
Is privatization an option here?
No, I haven't heard anybody talk about it. But hold on. So we've got tax reform, we've got Medicaid solution, Social Security solution, and a Medicare solution.
Right.
Those four things that the Club for Growth believes in, we think are fantastic, and there's varying degrees of bipartisan support.
But when you talk about entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, you're talking about non-discretionary spending and impacting that.
Right.
I mean, that's going to be a huge fight. You're still going to go up against some of the special interests like AARP.
Right.
That's a tough road to go down.
Right.
Is Club for Growth ready to go head-to-head with an organization like AARP?
We would love to have that fight. I've maintained for quite some time that Democrats hate entitlement reform more than Republicans hate tax increases.
Interesting. Congressman Al.
Ah, you mean the Democrats have something to put into this whole debate?
Of course, Congressman Al. It's what we're all about.
Okay, first of all, I am not an expert in economics, but the traditional concern of the Democrats since Herbert Hoover is that most Republican approaches are really the old trickle-down theory. Now, we have already got a middle class that is smaller than it has been in a long, long time. That has happened over a series of years. Now we're going to have to ask the middle class when they start dealing with entitlements and what have you to make. They're going to have to give some. If they are also going to have to take the burden of the tax that is going to benefit the wealthy on the theory that it's going to raise the economy and all boats rise and what have you. We've heard that before, and it hasn't worked before, and the middle class is hurting. It's smaller. A nation that has always considered itself primarily middle class is no longer primarily middle class. It is now primarily wealthy. So that any plan that is put forward is going to have to, I think, see that the tax structure does not put more weight on the middle class, because the middle class is going to have to give over on the entitlement side and on some other spending side, and they're not going to like it. You're absolutely right. They're going to kick and scream and shout and holler. But as a Democrat, I don't see any way for the Democrats to avoid give some too, but you got to be very careful as we go after those entitlements and those other spending programs. We don't come up with a tax plan that essentially gets to the rich and the poor that it will trickle down.
Andy, you got a response to that?
We've never taken an approach that the middle class has to pay more in taxes. I mean, we do believe in lower taxes and a broader base, and we think that won't trickle down. We think that will directly affect everybody.
Broader in what sense?
Well, like we were talking before about all these special interest loopholes that are just ridiculous. I mean, we can go through a long litany of them, and a lot of them are in the corporate side, like the ethanol tax credit. You can talk about the oil and gas tax credit. If you really get into the details of those things, you can get to...
Is farm subsidies on the table?
Yeah, they should be, and they are. And there's broad bipartisan support for that as well. But then there are things that affect the middle class that can be better handled at the state level. And there's
such as?
Well, this isn't necessarily middle class, but food stamps now are going above the poverty line. And we're spending $80 billion a year on it, and it's all coming from Washington. If you block granted food stamps to the states and let them be in charge of it and let them decide how to best handle these things, you would do a lot of remarkable reform.
Interesting.
And let me make one more point. Right now we have a tax structure that is very limited government. We've got low rates. It's in line with what our country's always been about. We don't have the high tax rate structures of Europe or in a lot of other countries. We have a spending regime that is in line or getting close to in line with Europe. So we've got low taxes and high spending. Now we need to either decide to bring the spending down to match that, or we need to raise tax rates so that we can become just like Europe.
Andy, we've got to go to break. Can you stay for one more segment?
Sure.
All right. This is Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. By the way, it's happy hour here at Backroom Politics. Time for us to open up our Jack Daniels, our wine. Our Congressman Al is going to get his martini, light up a cigar, and we're going to continue the discussion with Andy Roth, Vice President of Government Affairs for the Club for Growth here in Washington, D.C. When we come back in 3 minutes, stay with us.
You know, here on Backroom Politics, you hear us order drinks during happy hour, the second hour of Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. But what you don't understand is the quality of the drink that we're getting here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Backroom Politics premier sponsor. Hey, you got Dave Hammerly and the bar crew there at Shelley's Back Room that really know how to pour a drink. Whether it's something simple like my on-air Jack Daniels on the rocks with a splash of water, or whether it's something elaborate like what has to be the best martini in the District of Columbia for Congressman Al Twift. Wine selection, scotch selection that will blow your mind. They've got Highland scotches. They've got Isle of Skye scotches, blended, single malt, anything you want. Port wines to go with that great cigar from the great humidor. Down here at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. Come on down, have a drink, and make some new friends. Or heck, just come on down and listen to Backroom Politics on Tuesdays. Live at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. This is Backroom Politics Live on Blog Talk Radio. You can join the discussion at 877-662-3713. We're here right now, the usual gang of thugs, and joining us, special guest Andy Roth from the Club for Growth here in Washington, Vice President of Government Affairs for that organization, having a discussion about the fiscal cliff. We've talked a lot about the proposals. We've talked about the validity of Simpson-Bowles, tax reform. Let's talk about the back and forth now going between the White House and Congress, specifically the back and forth between Speaker Boehner and President Obama. We've seen counter proposals going from both sides. Right now, Speaker Boehner is talking about the Plan B. Not getting a lot of support in the Senate. In fact, many in the Senate have said that Plan B, whatever it will be, probably will not pass. So let's talk about the politics involved in this. Is this a matter right now, Andy, in your opinion, that you know everybody's not focused on the end game, but everybody's focused on maybe re-election in 2 or 6 years?
Well, that's always the case, I think. And I don't know if you guys read Bob Woodward's book, The Power of Politics, or The Price of Politics, about the debt limit debate of 2011, but it was remarkably instructive because it got right into the Obama-Boehner the negotiations back in 2011. And you got to witness their thinking of how they tried to put that together. And they were literally held hostage by their own parties. Like, Boehner says, I can't raise taxes because I got these crazies in the House. And Obama's like, well, I can't cut entitlement reforms because I got these crazies in the Senate. And I personally don't believe in it. So they structured a bad deal because it was the best they could get. We got downgraded. The market tumbled. And we're going to do the exact same thing.
Alan Moore, go ahead.
They structured the deal, but it didn't go through.
No, they did pass the deal in 2011, the August deal.
The first deal.
Yeah, he's talking about the debt ceiling deal versus the fiscal cliff deal. Go ahead, Alan Moore.
But that kicked stuff down the road.
Right.
Still again. I mean, they failed in their grand bargain.
Right.
They got close. Boehner got out on a limb and said, well, maybe I could do this much in taxes. And the president said, maybe I could do this much in spending. And they got fairly close. Boehner did not have a chance to go to his people and say, will you go along? He was very nervous. And then the president upped the ante and it fell apart.
Right.
So they got a deal, but it was a deal that set up the sequester that we're now facing.
Which they want to use to pay for part of this deal. They're double counting again.
Well,
that's literally kicking the can down the road.
No. I mean, they thought they were going to create an environment where action would be forced.
Right.
And lo and behold, it wasn't. And here we are. But I wanted to say something else about the current situation, because there is no agreement around this table or in this country about what would be the best. If you could play God and be the best, what would be the best long term for the economy? Andy would talk about tax reform, not increasing rates, leaving capital gains alone, that growth would follow and everyone would benefit, and what Al dismisses as a rising tide that raises all boats, and Al just simply doesn't agree with that. And I would have to say, after looking at the election results, that even though that wasn't the clean argument that was being projected in the course of the campaign, that more people support Al's view than Andy's view in the country. Now, I'm not here to reinvigorate that debate, but what I'm going to remind everybody is something else that's out there that drives people's thinking, and Al touched on it, and that is today the top 1% of Americans earn 25% of the income and own 40% of the wealth. The 25% of the income is the highest since the Depression. The 40% of wealth is the highest ever. Now, that is a backdrop to everything. So there's a little bit of, well, I don't know what's going to work, but I know that's wrong, that in the minds of many, many people. That can drive the environment we're in, that can drive some bad decisions, but I think we have to recognize that element, this growing inequality in the country, is part of this equation that many, many people are uncomfortable with. They don't know what to do about it, so, well, then tax some of it. Oh, but if we're only taxing income, that doesn't get at this wealth question. I certainly don't have an answer, but I just wanted to remind everybody that growing inequality sits out there and festers and feeds people's opinions as well.
Carl Tuven.
I think that this has to be done in stages. I think everyone realizes that there is a big problem that we have, and it's the debt, and everybody wants to attack it. But I think you can't do it all at once. First stage is getting a deal, some kind of a deal, and to not go over the cliff. and hope that the rating agencies don't go hog wild on us. The second part is tax reform, as you were saying, and hopefully that can happen in the summer or sometime this in the 2013. And then we've got to, then you've got to look at what Alan is saying about the inequality of wealth and decide what you're going to do about that. And hopefully the two sides, all the sides, can work together. We don't have a lot of the crazies that we had in the House of Representatives, so Boehner doesn't have that pulling him back from what he really wants to do.
But Andy, you know, when we talk about compromise, you know, and we talk about, you know, even though the crazies being what they are, you have the Occupy liberal left, those who follow the Nancy Pelosi's of the world, you have the Tea Party right, which follow the Eric Cantors of the world. It almost seems like the fringe is driving the majority into making a deal that just is not going to be anything long-serving or long-sustaining. Is that an accurate view?
I don't necessarily agree with that, because I have found that bipartisan solutions in Congress for quite a while now have only risen to the top.
Really?
Yeah. I still hark back to the Clinton years where there was gridlock, where there was violent opposition to the other party's views. But they did come to decisions, compromises, that were good, like welfare reform, like cutting the capital gains tax. Those, and passing NAFTA. These were pro-growth compromises. But before that and after that, there were a lot of solutions that were compromises that only grew government. I mean, obviously we know that compromising has occurred, and we've only accumulated more and more debt. If we're going to compromise, we should talk about how much to cut spending, not whether we should grow spending or cut spending. It should be how much spending we should cut. And we're not getting that. That may seem like that's what we're talking about, but we're really talking small ball right now as to how much we should cut.
But when you look at where, just in the instance of discretionary spending, you talk defense. That gets the Republicans riled up.
And that's wrong. They should be going after
them. Even after generals in the Pentagon are saying, yeah, we don't want all this stuff.
There have been multiple reports out saying, here's waste in the defense budget. A lot of the generals have agreed, and the Secretary of Defense has agreed, that there are prime optimal places to cut defense spending.
But it seems
and Republicans are so strident in their opposition to spending cuts in defense, that it's hurting them in other places. And that is a big problem with Republicans.
But don't we get into an almost Homer issue where, a member of Congress, Homer Simpson, or in this case, the home team advantage, where we all of a sudden we see, we'll cut defense, in the instance of, like, coming up with another BRAC, base reduction closure committee, when you look at the BRAC, everybody's like, yeah, close that one, but not the one in my district, and we come to a stalemate. It just seems like we're seeing a lot of Homer politics right now where it's not in my backyard.
Right.
Is that a problem that Club for Growth is trying to address?
Well, we recognize that as inherent in public politics. I mean, politicians almost always never operate with the long-term view of the health of the economy. They're always thinking about the next 2 years. They're always thinking about their re-election. They're always talking about, yes, I think that's a great idea, but I can't vote for it because I'll get kicked out of office. That's the inherent part of politics. That's why I have a natural distrust of politicians. That's why I think the American public should have a natural distrust.
Is that why we're seeing Congress at 7% approval?
Oh, yeah, of course.
Now, when we look at the possible deals that could come into play, is the Club for Growth supporting other initiatives, cuts in, across the board, or are there certain things that you feel are just too sensitive to be cut or already at the bottom line of cut?
There's no area of the federal government where the Club for Growth says, no, that's off limits, you can't touch that. We believe that every agency in the government has room for simply because public institutions, by their very definition, don't have a motive to be inefficient. So they're always going to be inefficient.
But how do you convince the mainstream uninformed electorate, whether it's in Oklahoma, whether it's in Maryland, whether it's down in Florida, that, you know, we're going to cut, it's going to hurt, but this is the only way we're going to come out of this rut?
That's a million-dollar question, and I don't know the answer, but I do believe that rather than lawmakers succumbing to their constituents' desires, I think that's wrong. I think they need to educate their constituents. You know, a prime example, and I know you may not like this, but Senator Jim DeMint won election in South Carolina, which was at the time a very protectionist state, and he said, I believe in free trade. I know that a lot of my voters disagree with it, but I think it's a good idea. I think it's pro-growth, and I think it will help our economy and our state.
And
the same thing happened with earmarks. Is a lot of people said, I disagree with earmarks. I know you as my constituents want the bridge, or you want the new road, or you want the teapot museum, but I'm saying no, and here's why, and I'll explain it to you. And I hope that once I'm done, you'll understand that I'm taking a principled stand that which you may not disagree with, but you'll support the integrity that I have to defend it.
Now, talking about the situation in Michigan, for example, you've got a Republican governor in Michigan who just invoked right to work. Club for Growth support the right to work initiative?
That's actually an issue that we've really never been confronted with, because there's never really been a national right to work.
But it does have national implications.
It does. I will argue that there is a fairly good argument against right to work.
How?
The Club for Growth can make an argument, and I support it somewhat, that placing a mandate, whether it's pro-union or anti-union, on any voluntary action between an employer and employee is not a good idea.
Wow. Not something we'd expect out of Club for Growth. I mean, Grover Norquist right now is spinning.
And I disagree with Grover on the ethanol tax credit. I think we should get rid of that thing. It's an abomination. But he would label that a tax increase. I don't believe that that's a tax increase. And we should get rid of it swiftly.
Well, is Obamacare a tax increase?
Of course it is. There was multiple tax increases in there, especially the 3.8 Medicare tax increase on capital gains. And there was the medical device tax increase. Those were legitimate tax rate increases.
So you support the Supreme Court ruling that says that Obamacare, going forward as a tax versus a mandate, two different things?
Right. Well, I think that Obamacare is unconstitutional on a whole multiple levels, so I don't agree with them on that.
Right.
I think they should have struck it down, but they support it for reasons that I don't agree with.
Alan Moore, you look just ready to chomp. Am I misreading that?
No, I'm just... reflecting on all this, I did feel a little compelled to remind Andy when he was nominating Jim DeMint for a Profile in Courage Award for saying I'm for free trade. It's a lot easier to be for free trade when Michelin Tire builds a huge tire plant in your state, when BMW starts building all of its SUVs in your state. So when you have...
Don't forget Honda.
But you also have the Milliken family there who are textiles, and they personally go after all...
Absolutely they do, but of course there's no textiles left in South Carolina, so there aren't a whole lot of employees anymore, and all those people who are trained are now working for BMW or Honda or Michelin. All I'm saying, I'm just reminding that there's nothing like experience and events on the ground to enlighten one, and they realize that the trashing free trade agreements works in conflict with some of the things happening on the ground that have been really important in the state. I'm not dumping on DeMint. I just wanted to add a few, as I like to remind my buddies, just a few facts to the conversation.
Well, you won't have Jim DeMint to push around anymore, so.
The earmark argument is correct, and it is true that it takes a very strong individual to say, as your representative, I'm not going to give you any money from the Treasury for any project that you have in your state, even though it may be a good idea.
And then, no, it's definitely true, and Republicans, I think, have John McCain to thank for that, because he was the guy who really went out early and would fly spec all these appropriations bills and call them out and say he wasn't going to help his state. He just felt it was wrong. It's a very difficult thing to do, and it was the front end of a movement which has made a huge difference. I say a huge difference. Billions of, you know, when billions of dollars used to matter, that's what we now save by some of the new understandings related to earmarks. And it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy.
Congressman Al.
In the 16 years I was in Congress, I can only think of two major public works that I did. And would be called earmarks now. One was to save a whole town from falling into the slough. And the other one was to build an interchange so that you turned the town into not being a parking lot. Neither were done quietly and slipped into bills. I remember to get the interchange done. I had to appear before the Appropriations Committee twice in two different Congresses to get that, and had to bring in the State Department, Washington State Department of Transportation head to come in and reinforce its need as an overall thing in the transportation policy of Washington State. I think the former Republican floor leader, Tom DeLay, that began to make earmarks very unpopular. He was passing them out. Now, I can remember when the Democrats did that. That was when Lyndon Johnson was there, and I remember going with my member, staffer at the time, down to a meeting with Carl Albert where they passed out stuff all over the place. Then that didn't happen much anymore until DeLay came along. So I think
Al, how we have short memory, Congressman. Alan Moore, take this away.
No, I'm not saying that DeLay didn't take it into some new places, but leaders in the House have been pulling majorities together with giving out little tidbits for a very long time, and the appropriations committees have had a line of people wanting to join in order to get in on the gravy train of passing stuff around.
I sure as hell wish somebody had taught me how to do that.
You might have stayed another couple of sessions.
Al, I think the record should show that Al wants us to know, because he only did this a couple of times, that he wasn't one of those everyday commonplace whores. He was just...
Did you just call members of Congress whores?
From time to time.
Oh, my God, Al.
A little bit impure.
Civility, sir. Civility. And by the way, I want on record that if Al had known, he probably would have done it if he had known what to do.
They loved guys like Al.
Yeah.
Because
they didn't
want to, they weren't lining up to join.
Don't make his ignorance as a reason that he did not go any further in Congress.
The greatest I've ever heard of is the Big Dig in Boston. It's about 27 times. And I got to say,
Tim loved it. Tim, that was Tim's big deal. Carl Toobin.
Listen, the
toll traffic in Boston is infinitely better than it was before.
No, it wasn't. I'll tell you that from experience. Carl Toobin.
You can...
Guys, Carl Toobin wants to speak.
You can decry earmarks all you want, but there are organizations who were doing wonderful things for poor people and others who were decimated because the money that they were getting from earmarks is not there. Programs had to be dropped. Programs that benefited people with diabetes had to be dropped. Other things. And you know, it maybe it was good to get rid of a lot of the things, the Bridge to Nowhere and all that kind of stuff. But it could have been, possibly could have been, you don't do certain things, but other things are okay. And
well, yeah, the argument that a lot of people say is earmarks were only a tiny, tiny part of the overall budget. So even if we let them go on, it never would be a driver of the debt. That's fundamentally wrong. And the merits of the earmark projects are irrelevant. The fact that it's used as a currency to pass larger, more egregious bills, that was the true ugly nature of earmarks, is that they would hand them out to buy votes to pass the big bills that drove the debt.
Congressman Al.
I didn't get anything, you know.
You didn't know how.
Because I was stupid.
Jesus, I always thought you were a man of prisoner.
Wow.
The two things I got.
They
didn't ask my vote or anything in order for those. And I went through a process, which is probably the process that you just do. Which is to, you know, because you can't just stop doing public works projects by calling them an earmark. Many of those things are necessary.
We've got 4 minutes left. Alan Moore, I'm going to give you one quick second.
Yeah, I just wanted to remind everybody that there are different. There's a whole other category of earmark that we haven't talked about and we won't get to, but it's tax earmarks, where chairs of the Ways and Means Committee in the House and the Finance Committee in the Senate use as their currency. They didn't have money to give away. They had tax benefits to give away, and that's the way they kept a coalition together. Sometimes big laws were passed only because either spending earmarks or tax earmarks were put together. But I completely agree with Andy that it creates this undercurrent of dishonesty in the system that feeds on itself and ultimately does very damaging things.
Andy, in the last 3 minutes we have in this segment, big question is, with everything going on, with the stalemate that we're seeing right now in the fiscal cliff, is there room now for a wholesale change in leadership in Congress?
How do you mean?
Is it time, maybe, Speaker Boehner, Nancy Pelosi, Harry Reid, Mitch McConnell,
they all
maybe shift chairs, or it's time for a new blood of leadership to come in?
I can't speak to Nancy Pelosi or what the Democrats might do, but there's certainly a lot of talk among the conservative base that Boehner is not representing their views, and he needs to be removed as speaker. I think that time is the enemy for those people, and I may be counted as one of them, because the House Republican Conference has unanimously endorsed him for speaker, and the vote will be January 3rd, and unless something happens, he will get reelected,
right,
and the next 2 years will be under his regime.
Okay, very good. We're coming up on the break. First of all, I want to thank Andy. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. We're going to ask you back, obviously, time to time. This is not an issue that's going away. So thank you very much for joining us. Oh, wait a minute. We've got a question here real quick. Let's see. Caller from the 214 area code, you're on the air with Backroom Politics.
Yes, was unable to listen on the site for some reason. It didn't go through, so I wasn't exactly sure what you were just talking about, but I'm assuming you're talking about this whole shooting. Is that correct? Is that correct?
Ron, we'll get to you in the next segment. Hold on. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the politics of guns and the aftermath of the tragedy in Newtown. This has been Backroom Politics Live from Shelley's Backroom, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We'll be back in 3 minutes. Stay with us.
Wow, a little bit of Fats Waller, Lulu back in town, and I tell you, when I am back in town, or when any of my friends are back in town, or heck, when we're living here in town, We usually find ourselves down at Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C., right across from the National Press Club. Why do we come here? Well, they've got the city's best cigar menu, the most diversified, with some of the best-known brands and some that you might even know, but you might want to give it a try. Everything from Arturo Fuentes down to Zeno. You can go all the way from your $9 little petite girly flavored cigars all the way up to the Opus X Lost City. They have a cigar for everybody. Mild, medium, strong, heavy. However you want to smoke it, it's available here at Shelley's Back Room. Come in, have Bob, Na, or any one of the girls show you what the right cigar might be for your taste that evening. Again, Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. As Bob likes to put it, it is definitely the place to be.
You can tell the mailman not to call. I ain't coming home until the fall. And again, I might not get back home at all. Lulu's back in town. Yeah.
Shelley's Back Room, 1331 F Street, in the heart of our nation's capital, Washington, D.C. We just got done talking with Andy Robb, who is the Vice President of Government Affairs for the Club for Growth, talking about fiscal cliff issues. We're going to turn back now to talk about the situation with the tragedy in Newtown, Connecticut. One of the things we were talking about before Andy joined us was the issue. This has now spurned the debate of gun control, gun restrictions, and how guns are viewed in today's society. Number one, I'm going to start with you, Bob Hines. You know, when we talk about the issue surrounding Newtown, first step everybody comes out are the extremes. One, we heard from Governor Rick Perry as late as yesterday evening, saying that we should give guns to everybody, that teachers should be armed. And then we hear the opposite side from a Mayor Bloomberg, which says all guns should be outlawed and that law enforcement should only be the ones we need to relook at the true interpretation of the Second Amendment. Is there a common ground here, Bob, that can be met?
I don't know if there's common ground, but both of those gentlemen are 100% wrong. All guns ought not to be removed, and obviously you're not going to put a gun in every schoolroom. I mean, the reality is we've got weapons that are killing kids and other people, and they are the kinds of weapons that you only use when you're trying to kill a whole bunch of people. You don't hunt with the kind of guns that they're using to shoot kids. We ought to be dealing with the question of, and we should stop saying it's gun control, because that gives too much of a pejorative. But here I'm a good Republican saying that sounds like just get rid of all guns. I don't agree with that at all. But I do think that we have got to regulate better than we do. You can buy guns at gun shows and have no checks or no nothing and anything you want. That's a hole in the gun laws. if we would just clean up the gun laws and make sure that the kind of weapons we're talking about.
But Bob, let's go back and look at this. I mean, we're talking about, obviously, a deranged, mentally unstable human being with just pure evil inside of him who got access to guns that were legally acquired by his mother. I mean, does taking away the guns fix the problem? Is there anything we could have done that would have...
Taking away the guns does not fix the problem. If by fix you mean there will never, ever be another mass shooting like that. If you outlawed all the guns, he's going to go online and find out how to build a bomb and throw it through a school window. So having a rational goal of reducing the number of deaths that have occurred because of the incredible freedom of military weapons that are being called guns, in the same sense that a shotgun, a rifle, skeet shooting gun are totally different. And I think you start by saying that you don't permit military type guns to be held privately, but you're not interfering with hunters, skeet shooters, gun collectors, etc. And then there probably are several other categories.
But Alan Moore, I mean, we're hearing a lot of the pro-gun advocates that are invoking the Second Amendment right to bear arms. We're hearing a lot of the pro-gun advocates using the old auspices of guns don't kill people, people kill people. I mean, does that argument now, after what happened in Newtown, have a leg to stand on anymore?
Well, first of all, I'm not hearing that. I think that the gun advocates are keeping quiet right now, which is the appropriate thing for them
Rick,
to do.
Rick Perry is not.
Rick Perry, but by
Michigan
large,
GOP is not.
Most of your conventional spokespeople for unrestricted gun laws are just keeping their powder dry, staying quiet. That doesn't mean they don't have strong opinions and they won't be heard from, but I'm not hearing that talk that you're referring to. And the fact that Rick Perry says, give everybody a gun, that's not a common line you're hearing. You have heard from some people like Governor McConnell in Virginia say, we need a big, broad conversation, and it's not inappropriate as part of that conversation to reflect on whether a school principal should or should not ever have a gun, which is kind of treading into that water. But it's very different than saying every school, every classroom should have a gun. Nobody's talking about these are not people who think about guns, who have guns by and large. The real question is, We can talk about some changes to the laws, almost none of which would have had any impact on Newtown. But they might have impact on the next situation. The one thing that might have had an impact on Newtown was these 30 bullet clips, these ammunition clips that allow a person with a semi-automatic, remember an automatic weapon, which are still been outlawed
illegal.
Since the 1930s.
Still illegal.
You can't hold the trigger and have it keep shooting until it's gotten over bullets. Semi-automatic means you have to pull the trigger each time. Well, you can pull the trigger three or four times a second. You can get a lot of bullets out in 5 seconds. And those are the guns that are the problems because they're the ones that are legal. But you can only keep shooting if you've got ammunition clips that have lots and lots of bullets.
So high volume, high capacity clips, you think should be regulated?
I think they should be regulated. Now, there's millions of them out there. If you start regulating them tomorrow, it's not as though you suddenly take them out of the picture. There are hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people who are going to say, I don't care about that law. I'm keeping mine because I might need it to protect my home someday. But is that an excuse for not acting? we know in our society alcohol and automobiles don't mix. We know that drugs and heavy equipment don't mix. We know that mental illness and easy access to automatic weapons don't mix. Does that mean we don't, just because in the first case we have all sorts of laws on those things, and that reduces the incidents, but things happen.
Congress,
we need laws here in order to hope that around the margins, some of these horrors might not happen or might be reduced in their impact.
Congressman Al.
Yes, and alcohol and guns don't mix. I can remember in a bar one day, there was a guy who was on his 18th beer, I think, and he says, I'll tell you one thing. Boy, when the Russians come, I'm going to take my guns up into the hills and defend America. And I said to him, I said, I didn't realize that you could bring down an ICBM with a 30-shot six. I almost got hit. You know, I didn't carry it in so much.
Carl Toobin.
You know, part of this problem really is safety. And what I think we have to focus a little bit on, how do you protect children in school? How do you train some people that when someone like this comes onto a campus or a school, a college, whatever, that there are people there that are trained to take them out or take them down? And the same thing in a mall.
They have that program. They had that program for years. The Department of Education had what they called the School Resource Officer Program, where a individual officer would be assigned to a school, and his sole purpose was outreach to the children for getting them comfortable with dealing with an officer in uniform, but also there as first-line security for instances like this. Now, when you talk about the School Resource Officer Program, I was talking to an official from the Department of Ed not too long ago. They told us that at one time, the School Resource Officer Program had $700 million associated with that. Today, that number is $70 million. They have taken away, basically, the School Resource Officer Program. Now then, is it in today's budget issue, do you increase that? This could be a knee-jerk reaction, but the reality is they have programs like that. But I can tell you right now, with my sister-in-law being a teacher, the last thing she wants, especially in New York City, is to have to be trained, along with being a nurse, being a babysitter, and being an educator, is having to be frontline security arming her. She doesn't need to know that.
I would say more money is needed in those programs, and they're not just for one person at a school, maybe three or four people at a school, and in a mall. Same thing in a mall. We've got security, but it doesn't work. And
yeah, but you're talking about something that's cost prohibitive, Carl. In today's budget economy, it would be tough, but Alan Moore.
Yeah, I'm a skeptic as to whether spending a lot of money to train teachers in how to defend the school. I mean, I see billions of dollars going, taken away from the education function and going to this other function that will almost certainly never need to occur, and so it's training, training to nowhere.
It's almost like arming the pilots in the cockpit.
And if you were going to do that, you'd be looking at high schools, you'd be looking at inner city high schools, you'd be looking at wealthy suburban high schools, you'd be looking at Columbine High School. You would not be looking at new town, fancy New England, quiet, friendly, wealthy, upper middle class, excellent school system schools. That's kind of the last place go. But it's a reminder of how vulnerable we conceivably are
as a free society
to mental illness, to a free society, mental illness, and easy access to weapons that can kill a lot of people quickly. If he'd been in there with a 30-06 single shot, we would have had a lot fewer deaths. He'd still be crazy. He could still have killed a number of people, but it wouldn't have been the numbers that we saw. Now, there are certain things in a free society that you just have to live with. But in this case, there are some things that we're probably going to need to do. It won't stop at all. There will be another horror down the road. But to do nothing, I think, would be to disrespect what we know and what we lost.
Carl Tobin.
I'm not talking about training teachers. I'm talking about other people who would be trained in this specialty that would be able to help.
But what people are you talking about? Are you going to put a cop in every school?
They did it one time. They had that program. It was called the School Resource Officer
Program. If you have a cop in every school, this kid would have shot him first. He shot in his way into the school. He would have started out and killed that guy.
In defense of that, I do want to bring this up, is, you know, the school resource officer, one, he's a trained law enforcement professional. I mean, he's going to notice and take a good clue. If a guy walks in with a .223 Bushmaster assault rifle into a school, shoots his way, if this had played out with a school resource officer, this resource officer is trained to know, hey, one, the door got shot out. Two, it was probably done with a high-powered semi-automatic weapon. He can take a defensive posture to at least try and use the minimal force necessary to subdue this individual.
How many millions of elementary schools are there in America? It's in the millions.
It is. It is.
It's, you know, we're gonna take highly trained people and staff every school with a guy with weapons in his own right. I mean, I don't think that's where we start here, because I think, as you said before, it would be cost prohibitive.
I agree.
To put that kind of resource in every school. And if you're in a place like Newtown Elementary School, how finely tuned is that guy's senses to react and respond?
Bob Hines.
I think the smart thing to do is see to it that we have a better way of making sure that everybody who has a gun is been registered, and they're not. I think we've got to stop that ability to walk.
The gun show loophole
is a terrible thing.
Right.
And just look, we ought to say you have to have a special permit to have any kind of a Bushmaster or an AK-47, and anything that has 30 or 40 shells in a single clip, outlaw that.
I can get a 10-round clip for a Bushmaster all day long.
Fine. What are you going to do with it?
I can fire it 10 times. Drop the clip and reload.
Yeah, that's right. Well, the point is, I'd rather have you having to reload than just keep going like this and killing people.
True.
Now, we're not going to be able to solve this problem easily, but if you do some things like that, you do a great deal to take away the opportunity for somebody to say, I can really do what I want to do.
Congressman Al.
I can't remember whether Bob said this before the program, during one of our breaks, or whether he said it on the program, but he said he had a meeting with Senator Inouye and about a broadcast issue, and the senator agreed with him on that issue. And when he got done, he said, "Now let's talk about violence on television, and we may well be back to that argument that television makes violence kind of common."
Well, not just television, video games. I mean, the shoot 'em up video games are tremendous.
And the president addressed that.
But his point is,
yeah.
My point is that beyond some kind of regulation over firearms, we maybe need to change the perception of the public about what is common, and violence is not common.
Well, this is obviously a subject that's going to be driving the public debate well into the new year. You know, obviously, it goes without saying, our hearts and our prayers and our thoughts are with the families who lost individuals in that massacre. Our thoughts and prayers go out to the entire community of Newtown, Connecticut. We're going to be keeping a close eye on the developments coming out of that. But I also want to give two shout-outs. Number one, the NRA came out with a statement while we've been on the air saying that they are willing to go to the table to, quote, make sure an event like this never happens again. Huge, huge movement by the NRA.
But extremely wise.
Extremely wise.
Right.
Credit
exactly.
to them.
Yeah, I don't give them, I don't see this as a huge movement. I mean, what else are they going to say? The question, the devil's in the details.
Well, having them come out and say, having them come to the table, obviously. The other shout out I want to give.
They have their choice. They have their choice. They're lucky if they're at the table.
Trust the NRA.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. But the other shout out I want to hammer on is to a Facebook posting and a press release put out by the Michigan House of Representatives Republican leadership not even eight hours after the massacre in Newtown. The Michigan GOP House leadership put out a press statement touting their new gun carrying law, and at the end of it saying, we don't want to politicize it. The Michigan House GOP, I put out a call on this show right now. If any member of the GOP in the Michigan State House wants to come on and talk about that, you all should. It is not only shameless, but poor timing, and it was just senseless. And that should be a headline. It has not come out. I went on a rant on Facebook about it. They even said in their press statement that any opposition to their press statement would be taken down. They took it down. That is just absolutely senseless. Absolutely. And I urged them to reevaluate how they did that. That is clueless. Now then, I want to go in lieu of my favorite segment, Tell Me a Story. I want to spend a few minutes talking about another loss that happened yesterday around 5 p.m. This nation lost a truly great statesman, a truly great hero, and a truly great voice for the people of Hawaii when we're sad to say that Senator Daniel Inouye passed away at Walter Reed Medical Center last night due to complications from a respiratory problem he had been fighting. Senator Inouye was a longtime voice for the people of Hawaii, a strong advocate for our armed forces, a Medal of Honor winner, and truly somebody who was not afraid to show that working with the other side of the aisle can happen. And that is a huge, huge loss to civility in politics here in this country. Bob Hines.
You're absolutely right. If Dan Inouye stood for anything, he stood for cutting deals to make things happen. He and Bob Dole were good buddies, as you probably
know. Well, they were in recovery at an Army hospital together.
And, you know, the reality is, when you look at something like a guy like Inouye, and you say to yourself, here's a guy who found ways to solve problems. You know, sure, he took care of his own state. He loved doing it. He loved earmarks for Hawaii. But the fact of the matter is, he was also a kind of a senator who found a way to talk to folks on the other side and find solutions. If we had two dozen senators of both parties, you know, a dozen of each, as much willing to do that today as we don't have, we'd be much better off. We need more people who are willing to talk and cut deals and not expect to get 99%. People who want 99% or the highway for the other guys are 100% wrong. In a democratic system like ours, you've got to make deals. You've got to be compromised.
Alan Moore.
Most people have never heard of Dan Inouye and are unaware of the fact that he was two heartbeats away from the presidency under the Constitution. He was the senior most senator in the of the majority party in the Senate. That made him the president pro tempore, and in the Constitution, after the vice president, you go to the president pro tempore in the case of, if you will, a double disaster. He was the child of Japanese.